This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Welcome back, guys. It's been a pleasure having Mr. Davey Coombs on here. Davey, I actually got a couple questions for you. I wanted to ask you this. You ever think about like changing some of the outdoor programs, like as far as the, like Supercross has that Triple Crown, and then like you kind of look at some of the other sports like NBA, like they have the play-in and things like that. I think as a fan and having you on here, like we always kind of sit back and like, oh, you know, how do we get more people? Like what excites us? You know, what are some of the things that you look forward to in Supercross? And I think we all agree like the East-West shootout, like is always exciting because it's a difference. And then the same thing with the Triple Crown. You ever think about doing some of that stuff for outdoors?
We have to some extent. And I agree that, you know, those shots in the arm are really good for a series, especially, you know, just to throw sort of a kink or an angle that's different. And the first thing we needed to do, though, was to get in step with Feld.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean Monster Energy Supercross. We have a lot of things that we're up against and the amount of time it takes to, you know, become proficient at Supercross for the athletes, for the teams. We've paid for it, quite honestly, with the Motocross of Nations last few years. Supercross is so technical now that it's almost like a science. You can't just, you know, wing it and win a Supercross.
Yeah.
And so the schedule, the rule book, everything is starting to line up now to be more creative. You know, there's no more FIM in Monster Energy AMA Supercross. And we're at a point where we're looking at a lot of things. And I can't let the cat out of the bag just yet. You're definitely on to something. But I've also had people talk to me about, oh, you ever thought about trying one moto again? And that's sacrosanct in motocross. People would absolutely lose their minds if we went to a one moto format, or what if we went to a, you know, all production bikes? That's actually a suggestion that Johnny Hopper gave me, like in the 250 class, you know, have a third class that would be, you know, the price point would be really low, which would help other teams. Those are all things to consider, but right now we're not broken. And we want to be careful with our next steps, because we all just made it through COVID. Yeah. And you know, whether it's, you know, MXGP, Monster Energy Supercross, Lucas Oil, Pro Motocross, we don't want to mess it up too much by trying something crazy. But I'm all ears if you got some suggestions.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to put you on the spot. I'm just kind of asking. Well, I don't think the one moto, I think that would be... You'd be bad. Going backwards on that.
You'd have a hard time getting people going out to Unadilla to watch, you know, to see James Stewart race one time.
And I think even with the production, when the getting it down to a price point, I think there's other ways you can do it to kind of maybe, I wouldn't say solve that issue, but make that issue, because people still go to the races to watch stars. You know, they still want to watch Ken Roczen, they want to watch, you know, Eli Tomac, you know, Ricky Carmack, James, or they want to watch these guys, Hayden Dean. So they go there for that. Now, you know, to come out there, like you said, to Unadilla for one moto, like they touched, that's why they went to the 20 minutes in Supercross, because it was so quick.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there is something that there could be different with motocross, because just like life, things are evolving. And I bring that up because you're a man, and like I never actually had a chance to talk to you about like anything besides a rule book and us at a race. So just to, just to sit here and ask you these questions, like me kind of as a fan, it'd be like me being able to talk to CEO of a company, like, hey, like, can you make some shorts for me? Like, oh no, I want some shorts. So, I think there is, you know, like you said, and it sounds like you guys are, you know, considering some of the options and for sure, I think it's more about, somehow keeping like once it, like where we are in Supercross, like keeping all the riders in tuned until the full season to always give them a goal to continue racing, not to, okay, well, we're out, we missed two races, let's prepare for motocross or whatever it is, or let's get ready for the US, or let's start Supercross testing early. And I think that part, I think figuring out something to keep everybody engaged like throughout the whole season compared to, you know, you miss two rounds, then you're out. And the motocross has always been the authentic part of the sports, like the grassroots, but it's here. And just like the social media, there has to be, to grow with anything, you have to have somewhat of a change. And I think the people who run in the sports, like they're in great hands with you being on there and then the other guys that's involved with it. So the grassroots and the foundation of the sport will always be there because you guys are here. But I think to catch up with modern day, like, and to engage with the other fans and to grow like OnlyFans and the Axel Hodges, there needs to be change. And in order to get that, you got to have the product, you know, and the riders there every weekend and weekend out. And to do that, like, I know as a racer, when I was out of the season, like, it was, okay, what's next? You know, I'm going to try to figure out, like, okay, my next seat, what's, you know, whether you come back from an injury or you decide not to come back. I think it'd be a good way to keep the product fresh and the people into stuff by some way coming up, whether it's a different format, a reset like they do in NASCAR, whatever it is. I think that there needs to be a change to keep guys racing from round one to round 12 and, you know, not to get to round like six and you're like, I'm out of this. You know, there's only like three people and then, you know, they're just there. So
all we can do is keep improving the platform, keep opening up opportunities for the athletes.
He's got something, folks.
For the OEMs.
That answer. He's got something.
Let's talk on May 7th.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, I'll be at a volleyball tournament.
Yeah, you'll be at the volleyball and I'll be maybe trying to get an autograph. All right. Well, I can't wait to hear more about it. I guess you guys are announcing it here soon. I know I'm excited to see the outdoor series. So I think we should.
What'd you say, May 7th?
May, whenever the last Supercross is.
Yeah. Well, either way, I'm excited to see it. So I think we're excited to hear some of the news.
There should be some news in between Supercross and Motocross this year. And, you know, but for right now, we're just focused on the 50th year anniversary. And then I'm going to take every good idea I get between now and then and the ones I've saved up and put them in the think tank and see what people think. And I would love to have your input as well.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I mean, we here as a fan covering it, we'll be covering it. So it's been fun. So yeah, I think that was it.
Well, no, not quite. I told Roger and Cole when I came down that I wanted to do something with you. I wanted to ask you some questions. I got some things I want to talk about. I want to know what was the mindset, what was going on, what was happening in your life. And so to help along with this, I reached out to Simon Cudby, Chris Holtner, Tom Vitti, Guy B, all kinds of really excellent industry photographers. Of course, you know, the Octopi guys, the Align With Us guys, and put together sort of a catalog of, I don't want to say number seven's life, but I would say it runs from, you know, Bubbalicious on a 65 to the last guy to win a moto against the Cobras on a Weisinger to the guy who invented the scrub to the guys sitting here right now. So
all right,
you have not seen any of these photos, but you probably might remember them.
Yeah, man. So. Actually, last time I was this nervous about somebody telling me this was the last DM trouble I was in. Like, I'm like, oh, what was coming? So, all right. Well, I mean, you are in Bubba's world, but I'll go in Davey's world.
All right. So I just want to flip the script on you because I'm not used to being interviewed, but I would love to interview you again.
All right.
All right. So let's begin with this photo.
Jeez.
I actually shot that at Loretta Lynn's 1993 when you were riding for AXO because Scott Taylor outfitted you. And that was the year that we were 1 year away from the Cobra. And I don't know who you're holding. Could that be a young Mookie?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's, I think my mom has this photo in there. And I think, yeah, it's the first title. I won the title that year, right?
Yep. And that brings us to the second photo, because they kind of go hand in hand.
Wow.
Look at those mitts. Look at the glove. And did you know what champagne was at this point?
No, I thought it was apple. Wait, I think I tried drinking it. Jesus. Wow. Wow. Look how big the Axo logo is on there. You're talking about the sport is evolving. Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. It reminds, actually, now holding this, it brings back a memory of being a dad now, like holding my kid on there. That's pretty sweet. That's
hey,
pretty
cool. I said that you were going to say, that looks just like J3. Like, I could see him making that
yeah.
face.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Wow.
It looks like one.
Because I remember 1 year I won. I won. I was winning one moto and my bike seized up. And then I won the next two or something. And then 1 year I was winning. I had a flat tire. And the next moto I was winning, I had a chain break. And the next moto I was winning and the bike seized up. So, wow, that definitely brings back some memories right here.
Well, how about this? In 1994, Bub Mamone showed up with the Cobra. And that was the big, big game changer. And to this day, only one kid has ever won a moto outright on a Zinger in the 50 class, and that was you. And this was that moment.
Big J's gonna love that photo.
Yeah,
Big J's gonna love that photo.
That's crazy. First off, let me fix this mic. That's
cool. There you go. There you go. That's right. That's better over there.
All right. Now it's gonna be popping. You know what? You know what I remember about that is that my dad, I won the moto because I think I DNF, right? I DNF the first moto or something. And then I won the next ones. But he picks up my bike at the end of the thing and saying like, Cobras is something. That's all I remember him picking up the bike, basically flaunting that. Like,
that they beat a Cobra?
Yeah, you didn't need a Cobra. Like these old PW50s. But that was it. Like that was, I forgot about that. Wow. Yeah.
Well, here was the program cover the next year for Loretta Lynn's. This is your first cover in your career.
You're going to make me tear up in this joint. Wow. Wow. I remember this gear, too, because this was the Bradshaw stuff. Like, I love the axle with the spider webs on the back. Man, that's cool.
Yeah, I always tell people that the greatest talent scout our sport has ever known was Scott Taylor. Scott Taylor found Timmy Ferry. He found Ricky Carmichael. He found you. He found Davey Millsaps, and just had a track record wherever he went. He could just pick a guy.
But those were all kind of in his backyard.
Yeah, they were on his backyard. Yeah. But Florida was not happening at that point. I mean, up until that point, I think the only Floridian that had ever won a national was Kenny Keelan. Kyle Keelan's dad.
Yeah, Kyle Keelan's dad. Yeah.
And here's one more from that day. And I'm very proud that I took that photo. I think it ended up in Inside Motocross, maybe.
It was in E60. And I think this is Paggio's hand. Anthony Paggio pouring water on me. Or it might have been Pete Fox. Todd Hicks, who knows? But yeah, that big black hand that still looks the same today. My dad, but wow.
Now, here's the transition to your days in the 65 class.
Gainesville, baby.
Gainesville. Yeah. And do you ever wonder, like, what in the world ever may have happened to number 161 or number 82, whoever those people were next to you?
Do you know who they are?
No.
Yeah. It's the next year. Like, yeah. This is, okay.
We're moving up.
We're moving up. Wow. I didn't expect this one, Davey. Yeah.
Well,
look at these bikes, man.
You had just started to get on the map at this point. And by that, I mean, because of your performance on the Weisingers, Kawasaki came calling, Fox Racing came calling, and suddenly you were a hot commodity. And I can remember people talking about how you were going to be sort of our game changer. And without a doubt, you were, but only in ways that we didn't even realize. And I remember doing an interview with you one time, and I was like, well, how's it feel to be, you know, the first, you know, black motocrosser to be this good? And you just kind of shrugged, and you're like, well, don't we all look the same with our helmets on?
Yeah. I was like,
no, this kid gets it. This kid gets it.
I would tell you one thing, like, there was things that, like, I remember, like, now playing games with kids. The things that they were saying, which was like, I guess at this point, like racist, that like that whole, don't we all look the same, was really like, that's how I looked at it. Like when I came up and raced, I never saw myself as different than anybody else. We were just so, all I cared about was being able to have a chance to play in the dirt with my bikes, my little toy motorcycles, and like winning on there. So when you asked me that was legitimately like how I thought. But this is cool, man. This is really cool.
So 1996, Tampa Supercross, a young James Stewart with the King.
You remember that one?
I remember that. That's so cool because I used to see him twice a year. Well, I guess three times because he had Gatorback. But a guy besides Jeremy was always cool to me. And I remember we switched one of the races. We switched jersey. He asked me for my jersey. I gave him mine and he gave me his along with Doug Henry. I actually got Doug Henry's number one jersey somewhere here. But Steve Lampson was always really cool to me. Like I remember we was in Las Vegas. I was in there for the World Mini. I don't know what he was out there for, but I ended up eating dinner with him and stuff and hanging out with him. But, you know, at that time he was teammates with Jeremy and I used to be able to go into the Honda box van because they didn't have semis back there. It was a box van and used to feel so special. Jeremy would have, he has all these fans and he asked me to come over there. So that was really cool, man. That's damn.
There's some other good ones in there too.
Now I got to ask you, you know, so not only do you get with Fox, not only are you the Team Green guy, suddenly you're the Oakley guy too. And I think that was also a Scott Taylor connection, but what were they thinking with these glasses?
The over the top. I believe that this photo was at US Open, right?
I think so.
Yeah, I believe because I remember wearing this one time at the US Open. I just answered this question and a kid asked me about the over the top for the first time. I think somebody's ever asked me about it, but I was so nervous on putting those things on. And I remember like, I think this was like a Cycle News cover, like one of the covers somewhere with those glasses. But it sent my career over the top.
There was another moment that helped really kickstart your career. And I've got some questions about this. Whatever happened to that girl at the Dairy Queen?
Dee Dee Burns? See, I think people, first off, like I remember her. She was a trophy girl at Dade City. And of course, you see that pretty little face down there. She kissed me. So I always like to say, like, it's kind of like when you go into one of those adult places where people dance and stuff, you fall in love with them. When she kissed me, I thought she was my girl. Like, I didn't know she was kissing every dude that won the race on there. And I remember her first name was Dee Dee. But when they asked me that question, like, girlfriend, I had no idea what Ricky and what Travis was talking about. But my girl's name was Dee Dee Burns. Yeah, Dairy Queen was Ricky. He was talking about eating ice cream. But yeah, if I said Dairy Queen, it was probably just going off of what he said. But yeah, Dade City.
If you're ever going to do a commercial for the Bubba's World podcast, you got to call in two favors. You got to get Ricky and you got to get Travis to come join you on the couch somewhere and just shoot the whole thing over.
Yeah.
And you could talk about Dee Dee Burns as being a fans only girl now or whatever she's doing.
Yeah. We need to get, it'd be the kids at the table on there, the adults at the table. I need to do that. Yeah. Get Ricky and Travis up here. We need to remake that. Wow. Wow, Davey. Wow.
All right. How about this? You might not remember this. That was the first time that we interviewed you for Racer X magazine.
Was that at Sean Murray's house?
Yeah.
North Coosie office. Yeah, I remember that. Yep.
Yeah.
We were out like wakeboarding on it. Over at his house. It was a Fox, something to do with Fox.
Yeah. Right? And Jeff Emig was there.
Yeah.
And you asked Jeff Emig if you could have his chain wallet because you'd never seen one before.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's it. I didn't get an order, did I?
Because I don't think you did.
Yeah, I think we went on the boat. Yeah, because we were watching Sean do his thing. And the theory about black people not liking water. Well, yeah. Wow. But yeah, I do remember that. That was in over in Lake Nona at Sean Murray's house. Yeah.
Well, you said one of the earlier photos is going to maybe make you cry. How much fun was it when it was just that? Just you and your dad and mom and little Malcolm and just riding dirt bikes.
Yeah. Honestly, like my whole career was like that. You know, we had more people around, but my family, like it was always, we were always family, like on there. Like it was, of course, you get more, you know, sponsors and stuff like this. And I think like when I, what was it, 2013, at when my dad came on the gate, we were struggling with starts. He came on the gate for a heat race at Dallas. It brought back so many memories, like on there. And so, yeah, this was at the U.S. Open too. I just won it, and I think I was coming back to defend. I think I won all three motos that night. Special.
And then you got up on big bikes. And I will say that I've thought that arguably Adam Cincirillo was the greatest mini bike rider of all time, but I've never seen someone go faster on a mini bike than you at Loretta Lynn's each summer. So fast that there was almost like he's going to win by a mile, he's going to crash by a mile.
Or do both.
Yeah. And this is the fuchsia gear you wore your last amateur race.
Last amateur race. Yeah. Loretta Lynn's. Did I end up racing A class or was that?
I think you were schoolboy.
Yeah, schoolboy.
Because you turned 16 on December 21st that year and you were going straight to the show.
Yeah.
So you didn't bother. You didn't even get up to A class. You were schoolboy and then go.
Yeah. People don't remember. I only raced like big bikes 1 year before I went pro. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't have a, cause I ended up getting hurt. I dislocated my shoulder. My first big bike race, it was after I won the won Loretta Lynn's, actually in this year. I go to I think it was Gold Cup or one of them. I end up going down the first race. Ricky was there, and I ended up getting dislocated my shoulder, so I was out. And so I came back in 2001, and that's when this was. And I raced Texas, won Texas, and then maybe went up to A class like pretty quickly after that. And I think I raced only a handful of races on there, and then I went pro. But because this was the gear I wore that, and I wore that Anaheim one. Yeah.
And then at that point, I remember your folks were starting to do what we would later see the Alessis do, which is go to amateur days at the pro tracks. So you'd come and do High Point, you would come and do Spring Creek. And I think that's when you're in the whoops here. That's when Simon Covey shot that for Fox Racing.
Yep. So I remember this. I came, Kawasaki wanted me to come to the National, and that was the only time I didn't ride. I didn't ride there. And I was there with I was cheering for Yogi because I knew he was going to be my teammate, Ezra Lusk. So I'm here watching the race, and the only tracks that I rode as an amateur was High Point, and then where was another? Where
are you? Buds Creek or Steel City?
Steel City. Yeah. And actually, I don't think I raced Steel City as an amateur. Yeah, I don't think I did. Mm-hmm. I think it was High Point, and used to have another track. I thought there was another. I don't remember racing Steel City as an amateur. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I rode obviously Muddy Creek, and mm-hmm. that's when Noel Brown, he was winning out their title that year, and he was going to come up and race the. Forgot what they used to call it, as a
Top Gun Showdown.
Top Gun Showdown. And then he came up and he did the Saturday practice, and JS was going to give him the business. And he's winning an outdoor title. And believe it or not, like that gave me so much confidence when I showed up against him next year that he didn't race me. Probably why I ended up winning the title. But yeah, he was winning an outdoor title and he didn't want to race JS. So yeah, but I raced those, High Point and, yeah, this was at Millville. At Millville.
Damn. Now, let me ask you this. And this is a legitimate question. How much would this have changed the balance of the motocross world had you gone through with it and signed with Honda?
Yeah, this would have changed. This would have changed a lot. And I think in a few different ways, it would have took Ricky away from Honda, because even in his thing, he said he wouldn't have went to Honda if I was there. That's part of the reason why he left Kawasaki, from what he said. So it would have took Ricky Carmichael away from Honda. So I don't know if you had the undefeated seasons on there. And I think Kawasaki was, Honda was still at that point, like a real strict company, you know, compared to where Kawasaki was a little bit more laid back. And I think Kawasaki allowed me to be kind of grow into the person I was, and the pink gear and just my personality. I don't know if I would have been able to do that like at Honda, but I think maybe as a bike standpoint, it would have been different, because I wouldn't have never went through the old four stroke issue. Mm-hmm. I would have had a four stroke. And I do believe at that point, for at least the first year in 2002, I think the Honda was a better bike, the 125. So
this episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list: teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
I think it would have changed my career a lot, actually, personality-wise, and what it would have done, not only for me, but what it would have changed the trickle effect with Ricky and... I don't think you would have had the Ricky Honda Honda deal. So
how did that photo come about? I know where it came from. It came from Pete Fox's cell phone, and it was an old flip phone, and he held on to it because he was, you know, on your team and didn't want any feathers to get ruffled that you were trying a Honda. But they came here with the bike.
Yeah, Honda brought down to, they were back when they were recruiting per se. Honda brought down Dan Bentley, which I was a huge fan of him.
Yeah, there was that photo that I'm sure Pete took. It was Dan in the garage with that bike.
Yeah, because I remember him breaking the pit board over Jeff Stanton when Jeff won the title in 92 that year. So I was a fan of and nervous of Dan Bentley. But they brought the full-on semi down. The whole team was down, and we tested. And, yeah, it was the first time I rode a Honda. And I guess it was the last time until I wrote it a couple of years ago. But yeah, they were trying to get me, and we were actually leaning that way. We were going to Honda because they were going to give me, at that point, you remember there used to be factory 125 guys on there, not before Mitch Payton. Well, Mitch Payton was there, but yeah, it used to be a factory Honda and factory Yamaha. Then they had the sub teams like Troy Lee. And Honda was going to give me the factory team. And then at the last minute, Kawasaki decided to do it.
And that was a big risk because they risked the Mitch Payton program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even Ricky had to do pro circuit.
Yeah.
And later on, Villopoto would have to do it, and Cincerillo. And
yeah, there was no factory 125 guy. I think maybe Damon Huffman might have wrote a 125, maybe, because he was riding the 250 class and he might have dropped down. But yeah. Kawasaki came up with the factory class because they did have Mitch Payton, and at the last minute they did it, and then we ended up going to Kawasaki.
Mm-hmm. So your birthday is December 21st. Did I get that right? So you're able to turn pro on January 7th, 2002. And like I said, you went straight to the show. Your first Supercross ended with like 100 crashes.
Yeah.
But your second one ended with a win. It was in San Diego. And to this day, you're still the youngest rider ever to win a 125 or 250 Supercross, you know, in that class.
Yeah.
It's 16 years, 20 days.
Yep. San Diego. Wow. Yeah. I can't tell if this is the turn right before the finish line, like there was a little 3-5-3 backward ski, or this is the one where I almost endoed after the whoop section. I jump off tabletop right before the triple. But yeah, this was a special night. And yeah, I end up having to go to last chance. I end up racing a day qualifier at Anaheim 1. I show up in pink gear. I got King Griffey Jr. there.
And you rode practice with Ricky Carmichael.
Ricky Carmichael, and they changed. Yeah, Davey can contest to this. They changed the rules of 450s and 250 guys riding together.
And they also changed the rule where they put you out there on Saturday with the rank and file 3-digit guys, and you almost got killed.
Yeah,
and you almost killed a couple of people. So yeah, they're like, if the factories tell us that this is their guy,
yeah,
we're not going to stick them out there, you know, and put them at risk.
Yeah, they did that in Dallas 2005 because I got hurt. And since I was out, I wasn't in the top 20 or whatnot. And yeah, they put me, had to ride the C practice. And boy, yeah. It was like I was riding that Biflow, like on there, coming through.
So that's your first magazine cover, the first Racer X cover. I think by then, maybe Don Maeda put you on Trans World or maybe MX Racer or something, but I remember that pink gear. And like I said, my second favorite gear of all time. I still like the light blue that you wore in, I want to say,
Vegas
04.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Vegas 04. Yeah. Yeah. And I think I rode it in the outdoor. I think that same year it was like a replica of Bradshaw, I think, or something. Bradshaw or wow.
So check out this little shimmy.
That's when I was coming into my personality, like then. This guy right here had the braces on. I still might have braces, but it was all about, like, I mean, I was always about winning, but I was still like, we all looked the same in the helmet and, you know, just trying to do it. But throughout the outdoor season, I think I started like blossoming, took my chest protector off, you know, after getting it caught on my handlebars for a few times, like choking. And then I started becoming me in there. And then so in 2003, that's when you started seeing the flashy. We had the silver. That's probably my favorite gear on there.
I think you're right, too, about even seeing that back then about Honda. They were so uptight and so corporate that could have been a big factor, too. Mm-hmm. So to know that.
And that was Jeremy's points whenever he left.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah, because there was, I mean, when you looked at bikes and the status of Honda and the Kawasaki, I mean, Kawasaki had the luxury is that, you know, my favorite rider at one point was Jeff Matasevich, you know, and so he rode Kawasaki's, and that's when I liked it, Mike LaRocco, because he rode Kawasaki's. And then obviously I came up through the Team Green program, but as far as the standpoint of what was best for me as a racer and the opportunity, it was Honda by a mile. Yeah. Like their whole program, it was Honda. And I remember me and my dad having a conversation, and I think even Tony Haynes at this point, we felt like Honda was like, that was the top notch. Like they were the best of the best. And I don't know if I was ready for that, because again, getting hurt, and then I only had a few races into the, you know, right before on big bikes before I came into pro, Honda might've been like too much for me because of their strict attitude, and they were the best of the best. So anything after that would almost be like going downhill. So I remember having a conversation with him, but he was like, Junior, like, you know, like they're going to offer you you're a factory guy. Like, you know, you're going to be up there with Ernesto and Ricky or whoever was going to stay at Honda. Like Kawasaki, you're going to be on Mitch Payton. And not to say Mitch Payton was not the factory team, but at that point, you still had the two different, like, you know, factory guys and satellite. So it was, I made the right choice. I made the right choice.
Well, so when that success starts to come at a pro level, it also meant that you started having rivals. Because as a kid, I don't think, you know, Michael Lessi and Brian Villapoto are always cutthroat rivals. Pastrana and Ernesto Fonseca were always cutthroat. Yeah. Carmichael and Charlie Bogard. But with you, you almost didn't have a mini bike peer. And then the first rival you had was Chad Reed.
Yeah. Yeah. Chad Reed was like the first legitimate like rival. I mean, I used to have Gene Stoll, Shane Bess,
the Suzuki kids.
Yeah. And then
Gene Stoll works in Pittsburgh and he has Segway tours around Pittsburgh, telling you the history of the town and everything.
Yeah.
Still loves moto. Still a great guy.
Yeah. Like there was a few of them. There was another kid. I can't think of his name right now. A kid on Yamaha that was pretty good. And
Justin Buckaloo?
No, I didn't. Buckaloo was like a class. They had 14, 15, 12 to 13, and I think it was 9 to 13 or something. 9 to 11.
And Gavin.
He was like before, he was, you know, at one point it was like Charlie Bogard, Brian McGavin. Buckaloo was, I think, still 1 year younger than them, but I think Buckaloo was like Travis. Him and Travis was kind of the deal, but they were always like one step ahead of me, Justin. And I think maybe I raced him one time in amateur and like super mini or something, but yeah, he wasn't a guy. It was kind of like a Brian Gray almost type of rider. And he's actually the only amateur guy that beat me straight up. And it was in Texas. It's kind of muddy, but he beat me. And like, I can't go through another amateur race where like somebody like beat me and I didn't crash. And he was the only person that did it.
You arrived on
Never did it again, though.
You arrived on the main stage right at the exact same moment Chad Reed got here. And I know that this was the first time you guys raced together. Did you have any inkling of how good he was going to eventually be? Because, I mean, he was on the four-stroke that year. You were on a, you know, KX125, but you were battling him straight up.
Yeah, I knew Chad was good. I knew Chad was good by the way he rode, but I think at that point, like, I was having my own little demons, like trying to stay up. But I never thought Chad was better than me. And I never thought he was faster than me. And in fact, I don't even know why we had a rival, like why I didn't like him, because we didn't race each other until this night. And
where was that?
Vegas. That's the 2002 East-West shootout. Chad had won the East, and you were riding in the West because you wanted to hit the ground immediately. And I think that your dad and the team were thinking that California, all those early rounds would be better for you and help elevate you in the public eye more.
Yeah, there you go. That was Pete Fox. Mm-hmm. It was Pete Fox, the reason why I rode West, because you think about like how much time I spent in an amateur on the big bike was not a lot. I just turned pro and I used to suck in whoops, like big time, like bad. I shouldn't have been racing West Coast. Like, I needed more time, but Pete Fox and those guys thought, like, for me and my personality, like, it would be best for me to ride West Coast. And so that's why I did it. That's why they had me in the pink gear. And Chad was dominating on the East. He had Brown and Langston and he won all but one race that year. Jessamine beat him. But even this night, like, Travis, you know, Preston won the title, but he was an afterthought. It was always James and Chad. So coming into that race, the media, like, put us up against each other, like those are going to be, because they saw Chad and how good he looked. And then I took that personally. And then that's where we go. So the whole fact of, like, Chad never did anything to me. But like when we showed up on that gate, like I was already hating him on there and I didn't even know the kid. And then I think he said, like, you might've just said it just randomly. Like, if I can get a start, I feel like I'm run with him. And I took that as like, he's better than me. So that's when you get into the Unadilla situation. So I wanted to shut that up, but wow, that was special.
Yeah. Now, that night, I think it was a different night. This is 1 year later.
Yeah.
This is when you literally overrode the track. I had never seen someone do that on a 125. And that was the most ass over tea kettle crash that you didn't need to do. But that's how you rolled.
Yeah. Honestly, Davey, that's one crash here that I still to this day believe something happened to that bike because I don't like that. That should have never happened. And even when I crashed, I wasn't actually overriding at that part, on there. I didn't like that triple thing anyway. But I think the thing bogged or it broke or something. But the way I got thrown over the handlebars, it wasn't I still to this day don't think it was something I did on there, the way I ended up flipping. And then that was it. That was it. I can't tell you. I can't, because I can't remember it. But yeah, I can't tell you what was wife went over to this day. I still can't, besides I believe something happened to it, and that's why I went, because I was too, the way I was riding that year, to make that mistake, I can't even fathom how I would make a mistake like that. I was so in tune with that motorcycle. And even when what started is when I slid off that on off and ended up going off the track, I know why that happened. I was cutting that corner too short. Maybe, not taking my time there, but this crash, I never even had anything close to that. So to go over there, I still think that there was something happening to that bike while I went down, and whew, boy, did I go down. Yeah.
Well, we'll get back to that, but I think this is a little bit out of order, but this is your first pro national.
Yeah.
And I can remember thinking, I can't remember a 16 and a half year old taking a victory lap at a pro national, but it was cool.
Yeah.
It's Glen Helen 2002. And I think that's Langston behind you.
Yeah. And I was so mad at Grant for following me. I didn't know why he was doing it. I know why he was doing it, because he knew what was building with this little 16-year-old. And I'm telling you, I felt so disrespected by him doing that. On there, I'm like, why are you here? You didn't even win the moto. You got two third places or whatnot. And but this is from all the Fox tapes I used to watch. And I said, if I ever won outdoor national, just like the Supercross, I'm taking a victory lap. I'm taking a victory lap. I seen Jeremy do it.
And it was ballsy.
Yeah. That whole fans cheering, as a kid, you kidding me? Raving your hand and they standing up for you. That's all I wanted. And so that's what that was for. And I did it at San Diego too. Victory laps, they don't do those no more on there. But oh boy, you know how long Glen Helen is. It's 2 minutes and 50 seconds racing. I took the whole thing.
I think this is, this next photo is
Hangtown.
Hangtown 2002. And I remember it rained.
Yep.
And everyone was thinking, oh, the kid can't ride in the mud.
I couldn't.
But you did that day.
Yeah, I did. And I remember when this happened. The only motos that the kid on the Yamaha beat me, it was kind of muddy. The only motos I lost as an amateur was in mud. So when this happened, I didn't think I could ride in the mud. There was nothing that said I could, and I fell. But that's the part of the whole wheel of, I wasn't losing on that. And I figured out how to ride in the mud because I was going to win the race. And I didn't pull the whole shot. I got a bad start, and I came through the mud guys, which is back then was Danny Smith was a good mud rider. And I remember I used to always looking through the program when something happened, okay, who's a good mud rider? Okay, Kelly Smith is good. Danny Smith is good. Brandon Jessman, he's good. And I passed all of them on there and just rolled through. So, second moto, Hangtown.
So back to the big crash in Vegas. That's a 2003 photo. That not only knocked you out of the East-West shootout, it also knocked you out of the first 6 weeks at outdoors. So you and your dad and your team decide you're going to come back at the fifth round, which is Bud's Creek. And that was the day they decided to run the track backwards, and all hell broke loose. And that's when we got this. This is a Chris Tedesco photo. The original Bubba Scrub.
The infamous photo.
Oh, is that who took that?
Mm-hmm.
Tedesco.
Yeah. What's the guy's name in the back of the Honda shirt? He was actually the suspension guy at Kawasaki when I first showed up there.
Who is it?
I'm trying to think of his name, but he was the suspension guy. And I remember
Anderson?
No. He had a boring name. I don't know, whatever said that, but yeah, yeah. But anyways, I remember like
Mitch Kumstein.
No, yeah, Sam, yeah, I don't know, but yeah, I remember this photo and I couldn't believe. I'm like, all right, like when I was doing this, I'm like, I didn't realize that I was like this low, and I didn't understand why people were like making such a big deal about it. Because if you start watching some of the races in 2002, I was doing it then. I did it at Millville when Chad Reed beat me that moto. I scrolled past him twice, right off the downhill there. So
I think that part of it was because of the way the track was laid out. And that's an infamous hill. That's, you know, yeah. Henry Hill, Butts yeah. Creek. But David and Art lost their shit over what yeah. you were doing because you were cresting it. You were cresting it and you were backsiding it, and you were, it was 2 seconds a lap.
It was fast. Cause there was, what you don't see is there was a bump right there, and I was pre-hopping this bump and like scrubbing over it. But the bump was, it wasn't big enough where I could just jump it straight up and down. So the only way I can get over it is by leaning the bike over. So that's when that started. And the second moto, I did a really good one, which was where David caught it. And he was like, oh my gosh, like, what did I see? But yeah, for instance, this shot right here was done because I was pre-hopping this and I couldn't do it just jumping it straight up and down. So I invented the scrub, I guess.
You also, over the course of 3 years, 2002 to 2004, shattered every 125 class record. Might have had a perfect season in 03 had you not started out hurt. Might have had one in 04 if you hadn't crashed in the first turn at Redbud. But you did decide at the last round to pull out the KXF 250. Because everyone thought, well, can he ride a four-stroke? And that lasted about 10 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I rode that bike maybe once or twice before that race. And I said it and I said it again. It was cheating. Yeah. It was so easy to ride. And like the way I learned how to ride a bike is, you know, not revving the thing out, like using gears. So keeping the four stroke in that low RPM. I think people just got used to me screaming that two stroke around. But this was more natural than round a two-stroke to me, like just how to ride this thing, the power band, the torque on how to do that. It was. I remember laughing like, these guys don't know what they're about to get into. And yeah, it got to a point where that year I was like focused on like the last race. I'm like, I'm going to win it by a minute. I think it was 120. But yeah. That was the last time. So I was actually the last guy to win it on two stroke.
Yep.
And the last guy to win a PW 50, like on there. Yeah. Damn.
And then things start to get
awkward.
Pressure.
Yeah.
And that is a Kenny Jones shot.
At my house.
Yeah. Our first cover since Jeff Emig in 98, where someone had their helmet off. Mm-hmm. And your whole life was about January 8th.
Yep.
And that became sort of a catchphrase in the industry.
Oh, I hated it. I hate it. Yeah. And at that point, you know, like I remember, this is one of the things that like, I'm if I can go back and do different, it would be this on there. Like, no. I mean, but like, I guess as a racer, you know, I didn't know what was in store for me because, you know, it wasn't really into the outdoors where I got a touch of that reality, but I've never lost like until then. So coming up and, you know, Ricky and I thought I'd run through him just like everybody else. And so at that point, it was, I think, winning so much and just kind of like, I didn't think anybody was better than me or whatnot. And so my whole life was about showing these guys on January 8th, like, they're going to get the business done to them. JS7's coming or JS259. And then it rained at 801. Yeah.
And that led to this cover.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. I can tell you what, though. I think the whole Ricky and the Eldon program got elevated that year because he didn't want me to beat him so bad. Like, he just switched to that Suzuki team, which when he did it, people were like, I think it was kind of like the same concept as Dungy when he went to KTM. Like, you're leaving Honda like for that. And just like the KTM and Dungy, you're like, hindsight, you're like, damn, that was a good choice. But I think Ricky wanted to like beat me so bad that like him and Eldon like put in the work, because I've never seen that kid so like skinny, and then it was like strict. And we all kind of knew like if I would have got him then, they would have never beat me again. And him and Chad, and that race was crazy. That race was crazy.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list: teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
As the season went on, and you did get your first win that year, I think it was in your third 250 start. But then when you went to outdoors, everyone jumped on four strokes, 450s, but you.
Yeah.
Is this the most underwhelming, overwhelmed look in history or what?
Yeah. I actually believe either this one, I think this is at, not Hangtown. I think it's Southwick.
Southwick.
And at that point, I already knew I was in trouble. I actually knew that when we were testing. I got blown past like by some guy I didn't even know on a four stroke. But still, like, I'm like, oh, my talent. Like, I just beat Ricky Dem in Supercross.
I'll make it work.
And boy, like, that was bigger than just James Stewart, like, in winning races. Like, that took a toll on me mentally, like that. Because it was again, like I said, it was the first time, like, I was going to the gate knowing there's nothing I can do, like nothing I can do. And I was still believing that I can, like, it was still me. Like, I was good enough that I should be able to win on this bike. I should be able to win on it. And people looked at why I was losing. It was on me, not necessarily the four stroke on there. But what they failed to realize is, like, only time Ricky ever got beat outdoors was against four stroke. Tim Ferry, Kevin Windham might just beat him, but I didn't get that luxury. And I think that's a part of just me and a whole life by January 8th. But by this time, I didn't even finish this moto. Yeah, I pulled off like 15 minutes into it. I was trying, riding so hard. I got lightheaded. And yeah, that was a struggle.
Well, the next year, Kawasaki equips you with a 450.
And equip me with something.
but so you were the last to win on a two-stroke in Supercross. You were the last to win on a Zinger. You were also the first guy to win on a KX 450F, Hangtown opener. And this is the race where you both go down early.
Yep.
And he comes through, and at this moment, he's got you passed. But you beat him to the outside of the corner. Chad Reed had won, and that meant that you were sitting pretty. Or you both passed Chad Reed. That's right.
Yeah.
You were both sitting pretty, and Ricky could not get Chad. So Ricky ended up getting third. So you had a one, and he had a three going into the second moto. And that was your
– Yeah.
That was the end of the streak.
Yeah, I remember this because his moto streak ended in Southwick 2005. He crashed while leading. And I think Chad Reed won that moto. So that ended his moto streak. But he won all the motos. I won overalls in 2005, too. So coming into this year, Kawasaki had a four-stroke engine on a soapbox. I don't know what this thing was. This thing was brutal. But nonetheless, I had power, baby. So I was going to figure it out. And yeah, he passed me actually going up. There was like a straightaway going up before that. He passed me there and I pinned it going down his hill and I hit a braking bump and he doesn't let off. I don't let off. And he ends up like kind of cross rutting and I cut underneath him and get him there. And then after that, like, I think he ended up running out of tear offs or something. I ran Chad Reed down for that moment right there to try to get that 1-3. And I ended up doing it. And then the next weekend, if I would have finished that moto, I actually think, like, when you talk about career changes, I wonder if I would have finished that moto off at High Point, how different Ricky's outdoor record would have been compared to like Mon's, like would have been. Cause I will personally say I broke him. Like I broke him and I ended up cross running going down and we know the story, but I remember fighting him that whole race. And you, as a rider, you can sense when you get another guy and where he's like broken. And I remember like one lap previous, I'm like, I got him. And I started pulling away. And then next thing you know, I woke up in the hospital. I don't remember what happened. And thank God you guys ended up changing that step down at High Point. But yeah. Oh my gosh.
That claimed McGrath 1 year too. Mm-hmm. Like in 92, he broke his femur, I think.
Yeah. I actually remember almost, it wasn't, you changed it and then you made it a little bit more mellower. And then I came back another year and almost did the same thing again. And then finally you just took the whole thing out, but
you're welcome.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah. That was, you look back, you're like, I'm surprised more people didn't go down there. But yeah, that moto about to finish those last two laps. Cause it was only two laps left. And I wonder what would have been different. Cause I just beat him at Hangtown. And so I felt like I can get him. And that was the first real race that we actually raced. Maybe like, honestly, probably the only race in my whole career that I would say I was racing Ricky like gloves off. Cause even when I came back in 2007, like I never fully like raced him because I knew he was only racing half the season. So I would do it in the first moto. It's like, all right, I'm gonna try to beat him in the second moto. I'm like, well, all right, he's on it. I always had an agenda, like just being here, but that moto in Hangtown or High Point, I think that was like the only race that we were at going at it like on there. And then, you know, case of history, I woke up and he was on the podium like, there goes my hero. Yeah.
Now this is one of my personal favorite photos by Simon Cudby.
Yeah, that was good.
That's just
the second sheer moto.
Yeah. Sheer joy.
Yeah. Second moto, Ricky threw out his shoulder. Or maybe that was actually your first moto, because second moto I wore number 3.
Because you're Team USA.
So. Yeah, Team USA. But yeah, I pulled the whole shot. And there was somebody else did that. I can't remember where, but another pro pulled the whole shot and like, look, I might have been watching on the Fox tape or somewhere.
It may have been Mike Alessi.
Maybe it was him. And I remember saying, like, if I ever get a start like that, I'm going to do it. And that's where that came from. But Simon was there. It looked like I was looking dead at him. That was awesome.
And then this is when your persona's like, this is your Rick James days.
2008. Yeah. Yeah. Rick James, after I won the Supercross title finally in 2007, and then I ended up doing my ACL. This was the old school race in Anaheim too. I remember we were walking track walk and everybody had on old school gear. And so from my Rick James stuff, that's why we had the glasses. And I didn't finish that night because my ACL was blown out. But yeah. 2008, Anaheim 2.
And then this one, we're getting out of order, but this was 2006. This was the most confusing series in the history of series.
Yep.
We both won.
Yeah. That's why I said, like, when we were talking about the racing on there, I think that's what it was. Yep, the World Supercross. Dallas cost me both those. Out front, Dallas at 3 points, ended up losing the title by 2. Yeah, that was crazy. And I remember like there was a big deal, the World Supercross series, until Scott Taylor, which bless his heart, man, he was poor as boy. He somehow dumbed that thing down to where like that World Supercross title was like, it was an afterthought. But yeah, that was special. We both out there with number one plates, but of course I wanted the AMA one to Vegas.
And so when Ricky retires, there's an opportunity for you. And that's when you teamed up with this guy, Eldon mm-hmm. Baker.
Yep. Eldon Baker. And I talked about it in the podcast, like there was things that like I wanted to you know, learn and you know, just kind of figure out the program. So it worked out. But a part of it was like not letting him go to like Chad Reed and, you know, the other guys to kind of maybe stop that part from happening. And perception, you know, I said enough sugar and donut water, sugar water and donuts. But yeah, I teamed up with him and then, I was here. This is at Phoenix. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there worried because my ACL was blown out and it was hurting, but I won anyway.
And by the end of the year, you're undefeated now.
Yeah.
And that was the last key ingredient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That outdoor title was miserable, but so much fun, like so much fun. Just all athletes talk about how you wish you enjoyed the process and like just doing what I still watch YouTube and I still can't believe I did it and how special and how, you know, how much luck is involved in doing something like that. But yeah, this one, again, second race at Phoenix. And this was that look right there was an ACL, like worried. And then this look right here was, you know, the title that I always wanted was that outdoor title. And it was the only one I didn't have. And I think at this point, I'm still the only person to win, I believe, East, West, 125 titles. All 125 was in East and West. The World Supercross, AMA Motocross, and AMA Supercross. I'm the only person that's ever done that.
Out of 125?
No, just all the titles on there. I mean, the world is gone. But yeah, because Ricky, he won East Coast, but he never won West. He didn't race it. And then I did both. I won East and West. And I won the Motocross 125, 250, 450, and both in the Supercross too. I don't think there's anybody else that's done that.
Well, the vault would know.
Yeah, the vault would know. Like, I sense, like, he's like, should I let him go?
At Langston, but he didn't win.
He didn't win the Supercross.
Yeah, he didn't win both of the regions.
And he didn't win the Supercross.
Yeah, he didn't win, yeah.
Yeah.
But he covered almost every other base, and he had a world championship.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I might care about that. Yeah. Come on over, Jeffrey.
So this is... I think this is Jacksonville.
2009. Yeah. Yep. 2009.
How close were you guys to actually fighting?
We weren't going to fight. Yeah. He wasn't even looking at me. We're kind of looking. Well, we could see we both were looking through each other. But I remember Rado told me he like lift his hand up and I didn't flinch. And he was like, boy, like all the boys in the hood, you to flinch, like on there, like on there. And but I don't think we were close to fighting. I think it's more the
sports.
I mean, he was mad. Like we were mad, but I got the best of him that night. But we were talking about how he ended up, I cut him off that jump in the air. And so he was pissed about that. And then then he grabbed my neck at the end of the race and then, I think I gave him the clap or whatever. But yeah, we weren't going to fight. At least I don't think so. Phoenix, a couple of years later,
we would have fought.
Yeah. Well, we're getting ready to transition. Just we're in the home stretch. We're almost there. But I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about a certain day in England in 2006.
Yeah, that was awesome. That's the first time I heard Booba. Yeah, Booba. And it was actually the first time I realized like how big a biggest star, how much people like enjoy like seeing me. And I don't know if that's the England one in 6 or 8, because I raced in England both times. Mm-hmm. But I had a phenomenal time in 8. My tooth was hurting in 2006. but the people and the fans, man, it was crazy. And it was the first motocross nation I ever went to. I never went to them before because they were big, but they're not like how for a few years, about 10 years there, they became like, they became back to the honor and stuff. Because I remember like it was almost in the 125 class. It was like, oh, you don't want to go. Kawasaki, like, we don't want to go. And get hurt and whatnots. But then when you had an opportunity to go those years, it was like you had to. And I think Ricky, you know, Ricky and Pete and, you know, everybody kind of made it an emphasis where the fans got back onto it, where they were like, it was a pressure, but Yeah, that was fun, Stefan Nevers.
So now we'll skip forward to 2009. You and Chad really don't have a good thing going. And I think it's probably because you took his ride, because he'd won the Supercross title in 08 where you were hurt. And then you signed with San Manuel and Larry Brooks. And I got to say, this is one of my favorite cover photos we ever had.
Yeah, that was special. That was leading into the Supercross season in 2010.
10, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, because that was the Red Bull gear had.
Red plate.
And I remember us going up to with the Nike boots. We flew over to the whatever it was, the Catalina Island, and we did that whole press release stuff.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah. I actually think this was at my house right here from the Red Clay. But yeah, that's when Ryan Dungey came into form on there. And you didn't see that one coming. But yeah, I thought I'd run through him just like that, but I broke my navicular. And then that was a bad injury right there.
That was like 10 months, I think.
It still hurts.
So I can't figure out what year this is.
13?
Is that Daytona?
No. 12.
No.
That's Daytona.
No, that's Anaheim. That's Anaheim 2005.
Oh, so this is the heat race win.
The heat race win.
Okay. That's why it stumped me.
Yeah. I remember about a year.
And then you were mentioning Ryan Dungey. And then, of course, Ryan Villopoto was hot on his heels. Mm-hmm. And I thought this was a really cool cover. You weren't in a good spot.
Yeah,
but you had two guys that were challenging each other, and they were pushing each other while you and Chad were kind of focused on each other.
Yeah.
And it kind of opened the doors for both Ryans.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is in 2012. And I want to say that's a...
What race was that?
I want to say
Phoenix.
No, I think it was... No, Phoenix I had on yellow and red gear. I want to say Dodger Stadium. Mm-hmm. It was either Dodger Stadium or... Yeah, it was Dodger Stadium because I could tell by the white dirt.
You got hurt in practice, didn't you?
No, I had another big crash in practice. Or maybe I did get hurt.
No, because you went straight to the heat race. Well, I went a couple laps.
Yeah, well, that got... Partly, I didn't want to die on that. But yeah, this is, I think this is, it's just odd. They both got red plates, whatever race they both were tied in points.
The reason was exactly, they'd each gone like 1-3 and 3-1 or however it worked out.
Yeah. I think this is Dodger Stadium.
Was that the night Trey Kinnard got jacked up?
Yeah.
And then this is just one from your Yamaha days. I think this.
Atlanta.
Is that a Gibbs bike?
Yep. Yeah, it's Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I already know where that's at. Yeah, this is fun because all these different races, I can tell you exactly where all this stuff is from. Yeah, Atlanta heat race because I didn't win the main event, so I wouldn't have been whipping it. Yeah.
All right, how about this one? You switched to Suzuki now.
Yeah, this first win, San Diego 2014.
It's like a photographic memory.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then this one's easy.
Monster Cup 2013. That was I guess that would have been the one I won the whole thing. Because I was about to say it's the one I won the second one, but I didn't do that. I think I just went like this over the finish. Because Villopoto was laid out. I didn't want to celebrate too much.
And then... this is one of my favorites. I think Garth Malone shot this.
Yeah, we were shooting a Red Bull commercial, and it was off that Instagram clip that I did. And I always wanted to do that and grab a can. I would have been able to do it back then, but I wanted to be able to do it and like reach down and grab a can. But yeah, that was with Garth. We actually did this photo shoot twice because you see the clouds. This ain't even the photo that we use for the photos. Because the clouds back then, it's just not clean, Roger, and all this stuff.
I think the other one you were wearing that camo.
The video we did when we had to redo the video, it was the camo gear.
Yeah,
but yeah, we did actually use this photo because the clouds for the poster.
Yep.
Yeah,
I think Art sold that photo probably 500 times.
Yeah, that was special. Yeah.
Now this is also special.
Yeah, last win. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Second moto, dominated. Oh, that was
a good weekend.
That was a great weekend. And this was right before FIM got me. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the weekend. That was
it. You were having a good weekend.
Yeah.
Kevin Crowther from the AMA and the FIM came and said, look, I know it's your home race. I didn't want to kind of mess this up, but James is in violation. He did this, the TUE, the Adderall, whatever. Mm. And my sister was ready to fist fight him. She's like, you're not taking him out of our series. But unfortunately, the whole FIM chapter, whether it was the fuel, the drug testing, what happened to you, what happened to Cade, what happened to Brock, what happened to Christian, it's a chapter that what were we doing?
Yeah, it was difficult just because, again, I think, not to like revisit on this thing, but it's the first time I ever actually had a chance to like talk to you. I think everybody was in agreement that you're like, okay, now, like, I mean, it's not like this guy's sitting here like, cheating. And it's not like, at that point, FIMs, they were around, but like the whole drug testing and stuff, like we all knew, you don't cheat. There's a drug testing policy. So if you're not trying to cheat, there was no mention of, I guess, TUE forms and really into it.
At first, there was not a lot of education on behalf of the FIM.
Yeah.
And to some extent, Feld. And when MX Sports started doing drug testing, that was a mistake that we steered away from. We made sure to, because you had to test for Supercross first.
Yeah.
And I.
But it was two different, like, one, USADA and WADA.
Yeah.
USADA was here in America, where WADA was, the world anti-doping, even though they're the same deal. But for sure, I remember that year, we had little pamphlets and, you guys did do that, but I almost feel like it was, in Supercross, there was nothing, and I really didn't have it. No reason to even look for it either, because it wasn't, not worried about cheating. And I guess the hardest part was just the whole process of going through that and then sitting across from the guy and him saying like, no, I know you ain't cheating. And, I'm like, I did have paperwork and all this. You got to get a form. Okay. Like, that's what I missed. Like, I didn't fill this one form out, but I had stuff and you guys knew about it. And then to go through the USF.
Yeah. And you have to remember your positive test, or when they said, hey, he's got something and he doesn't have a TUE for it, that happened back in April.
Yeah. It was
at the Meadowlands.
Yeah.
And they came and told us that's Father's Day weekend. That's middle of June.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why, again, like when you start hearing stuff like that, like it was, you start wondering, like, is this like set up? Because I remember next year, Villopoto goes over to he races over in the world, MXGP stuff. And then we were like sitting there, okay, well, that's one way of taking their champ out, one of the main guys, and then, focus our whole thing over here with Ryan being here. And it was that was the frustrating part. Like, you're talking, I took this test back in April, like on there. You guys knew that night that I was taking Adderall because I showed you I was taking it. Like, I gave you the form. So it's not like it just popped up, and to hear it out there, like, I'm just starting to get on the roll. I won one moto the weekend before at Colorado, and then went 1-1, and then boom. And then to find out people knew before I knew,
that was a messed up part.
So I'm like, I started getting calls before, and then, but I'll tell you this. I never blamed you guys for it. Like,
we had nothing to do with it. It just happened to happen that the news came not in the middle of Supercross. The news came in the middle of motocross, and we weren't even FIM.
Yeah.
But they're like, if he rides, his penalty is going to be 4 years. It could be worse. It could be a lifetime thing. And we're just like, and I think that Chad, who was, you were working with at the time, and my sister, we're trying to, and this is the other shitty part. You're trying to litigate that in Switzerland.
Yeah.
And you can't get a hold of anyone on the phone. Yeah. And if there's any legacy to it, it's that they did get their act together and after that. But it was wildly embarrassing across the board.
Yeah.
Certainly for you.
Yeah.
Certainly for both series. And it was the beginning of what would become the end of the FIM relationship because it was handled so poorly.
Yeah. I mean, the same thing for me. It was the beginning of the end, like, for me. I mean, that took out a lot. I mean, you think about my whole career, like, I mean, cheating was something, like, I never even thought about.
Your dad,
like,
made you ride stock bikes.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, yeah, exactly. Like, we would do the opposite to get better. So to be called, like, a cheater, like, that got to me. And I remember, like, continue racing outdoors and just dealing with, like, that whole aura
the
around
stigma.
Me and the stigma, and then, like, not sleeping and then trying to fight this thing. Well, why continue racing if you think you're going to get suspended? And you know you're going to get suspended once the USADA one comes back. And then finally, I think I almost had, like, a nervous breakdown at Millville that year because I wasn't sleeping. And then that was the last race. But yeah, you think about, we took the test in April. I mean, I found out 2 weeks before Anaheim, like the next season.
That you weren't racing.
Yeah, that I wasn't racing. And I went through the boot camps, like all that stuff, like thinking I was racing. And I'll tell you this, it was the best I think I've ever riding up there. Like, the leading into that season, there was no doubt I was going to win. And then have that pulled away from me. But then hindsight, I got my first kid from that, like being let off. And I'm glad it happened because I would take my kid, like, over that any day. So there's always positives to, you know, situations. But the biggest thing was it was just the stigma of people thinking I was cheating for that time period that killed me, because that was the last thing I would ever do. So.
And then this is the only, I think, really unfortunate photo. This is the last photo we have of you. Last lap, Washougal.
Yeah.
I think you're in 15th place. No offense to Benny Ross, but I think you were back there.
And this is it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is like the little jump right before
the Ten Commandments, or what do they call them?
Yeah, was it? No, I think this was actually... It could be, or the rep before the mechanics era, because I might have pulled out two corners before that little, like, jump. But yeah, that was it. And I give the fans credit, man. They were cheering like I was still winning, and I had blisters on my hands. I couldn't hold on. People think I, like, stopped. I couldn't even hold on anymore. I don't know, with too much baby powder on my stuff. But yeah, it was sad. Like, yeah, I just never got going that year. The first race, I get knocked out with Ryan. And then we had that suspension issue with the air forks leaking, and that dealt with a lot. And then I get the first race at Hangtown. I come out and I get hurt my shoulder, try to come back at High Point. And then it was just like, I can never get going. So this photo right here was just like from the FIM back in April 2014, all that correlated up to like this is it. But I didn't retire that day, though. It wasn't until, like, you know, I was still planning on coming back in just a different way. But yeah, I didn't think that was the last time he would see me.
Well, let's end it on a better note. And that is, this is one of my favorite photos, because I don't know why I just, you know, Simon shot that. And to me, it shows the Stewart family's love of what you do. And, you know, there's got to be some real pride in what Malcolm is doing and what Malcolm has done, because I remember when he was a kid, he'd rather go fishing.
Yeah.
And he may still rather go fishing.
Yeah. I think
he might be fishing right now.
Yeah. He might be taking it. He's trying to get his fishing line over here. So no, 100%. And, you know, I always thought, you know, with Malcolm, I remember, like, here he crashed, you know, he swapped out on his PW50 and he quit for like 3 years on there. But there was just, He was almost like an afterthought for a while. Like, if you want to do it, you can do it. But my parents were, like, so focused in on, like, me at that time, that Malcolm, you know, he was just being a kid and laughing and enjoying the races, being a kid. And then there was a point where he kicked in, and I think he really started wanting to race when he raced the two-stroke at, I think it was Mini O's that year, when he won some championships that year. And people were saying he was cheating because he had one of my old like two-stroke motors, whatever. But that's when he kind of started coming back. But yeah, it's cool to watch him, not only for what he's doing now, but just to get through that. And I think it's hard to understand unless you've been there, the pressure of him fighting through that, you know, like always being second fiddle or not second fiddle, but compared to your brother, you know, he's becoming his own person and doing it because like he wants to do it. And it's coming soon. So yeah.
Well, that was fun.
Yeah. Thank
Thank you for and Cole, any mistakes? Do we hit all of our marks?
Perfect.
Roger.
Photo ended cool.
All good.
Perfect. Well, yeah, well, hopefully you guys enjoyed that. This took a different world, a big turn. And yeah, I didn't expect this, but this was down memory lane to the fullest. And Davey, I appreciate everything. You know, from the beginning of my career, from everything from Loretta's and you know, just the support from you and your sister Carrie, MX Sports, like I mean, you guys don't understand like how, you know, important this guy is and has been to our sport and will continue to be. And so when I was telling Rod yesterday, they always do the Mount Rushmore of, you know, Rodders, and, you know, they debate Ricky, myself, Chad. But if we were doing one on the most influential people on the sport to get it where it is now, this guy would be at top of the list.
You got my list.
Man, I appreciate that. I am the sum of my parts and I'm a mom and dad son. And, yeah. and I just get to play motocross every day. And we're lucky enough that the people that we get to work with, the people we get to work around, the people who come to the races, my mom's 80.
Yeah,
and she's still running sign up at the GNCC. Yeah. Loves it,
yeah.
It's just like your family is a motocross, supercross racing family. My family is a motocross, supercross promoting family.
Yeah,
and I just got lucky that when I wasn't good enough as a racer, I found something else, and it was publishing, and the promoting thing I just stumbled into. But the fact that I get to come here and spend the day bench racing with one of the guys on Mount Rushmore and Cole Beechnuts and Roger is, I got the luckiest job in the world.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. What a feeling is mutual. And, you know, I think again, like now being here, it's nice to be able to embrace all these, you know, opportunities, go down memory lane and not, you know, not have an agenda besides like enjoying it. And I think being where I'm at now and all of us, you really appreciate, you know, and I appreciate the things that we've both done and done together. And every word I said, I meant, and, you know, I wish I would have been able to like look at it for what it was as we were doing it, but that's what made us who we are. And that's why, you know, we're where we are and the sports continue to grow. So I appreciate it. As for what you've done for me personally, and then I know for all the fans here watching, you know, we appreciate it because the sport wouldn't be where it is if it wasn't for you. So I just want to say thank you.
I appreciate that. And I'm sure I'm glad you were part of it. I'm glad you're still a part of it. And that's difficult now that you're the second fastest steward.
Yeah, that's all right. I embraced it. When you wasn't good enough, you did publishing. When I wasn't good enough, I'm sitting here talking about how good I used to be. So, but yeah, that was it. Again, David Kuhn, we got to thank our guests for coming in. Roger's good to see you again.
Good to be here. Thanks again,
Cole Beach. I think the moment says I'm going to say your name fully, but, this has been good. This has been a great episode, and it went down a different road than I thought, but man, it's been a good day. So I hope you guys enjoyed this. And that was episode 5 from Bubba's World. I want to again thank Mr. Coombs, Davey Coombs, and I will check you guys next time. See ya.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.